once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, where we're having entirely too much fun.
Way, way, way too much.
And I don't even understand why we're having so much fun.
We should stop it immediately.
Okay. So what do we need to talk about? Oh, yeah, I had something. I wanted to talk about.
Okay, what? Oh, I've got some things to talk
about. You do too.
Wait a minute. We should actually do like a talk program where we have things to talk about and we should talk about things.
We could do like talk radio.
Oh, what an idea.
But you know, in a symmetrical universe, you'd also have to have tick radio then.
We have ways of making you tick.
Talk.
Talk. I mean, tick. Talk. I have ways of making you tick. I mean, talk. Yes.
Right.
Clocks. And there are there's a whole generation growing up that doesn't even know what we're talking about.
Yeah, but see the whole thing. Then if we did that, it'd be a clock, right? So it'd be clock radio, and clock radios
that exists.
Used
but
to
again,
be really
it's not,
popular.
They did exist, and the TikTok used to exist as well. It doesn't. I mean, there's people growing up. They're like, what is the TikTok thing? What is this clock radio business? Mm-hmm. Why would you want? My iPad is my clock. It's an app.
Well, and we still say dial telephones, okay? Dial your telephone.
That's true.
We don't really have... Actually, we touch our telephone, but this doesn't work somehow, you know. Touch.
But you have something to talk about. Let's go to that subject.
Okay. Let me tell you some things that are going on in the practical side of the economy where hopefully the people who listen to our radio
program... Oh,
darn,
I thought we could stay with the impractical.
Well, no, but it's, you know, and it, the people that we work with. There's a lot of things going on in the big, bad, wide world out there that are potentially dangerous. And during times when yields are low, which
on bonds.
Has been a lot recently, there is a powerful tendency for people to want something that pays them more money but doesn't involve selling shares. In other words, this whole concept, which is, by the way, a fake mythological concept of don't touch the principal. Don't touch the principal basically means that whatever it is that you're doing is generating enough income that you can live off of it. And that's certainly true if you want to live at a reduced standard of living and you have millions and millions of dollars. But the going interest rates today on something that's safe and relatively secure are extremely low.
You have to have a lot of money to make even a small income off of that.
So unless you happen to be somebody with $10 or more million to invest.
And you only want to make, say, $100,000 a year.
Right, and you'd like to make $100,000 a year. Well, okay, you're probably in pretty good shape.
You could do that.
Otherwise, you wind up in a managed position, which people don't understand very well, and is something that doesn't easily fit with the aphorisms, the mythological aphorisms from the newspapers of the 1920s and 30s, which is the ones we use for great economic wisdom today and quote them without thinking about them. So what people do then is they have a tendency to believe that somehow insiders, somehow super smart people and super powerful people or something can make money in ways that the regular, ordinary, dull folks like us at the Personal Wealth Coach can't do. There must be some super secret, inside, cool way of doing things, which is why people like Madoff do very well.
Yeah, Madoff shows up and says, well, this is a secret thing, and I can't tell you how I'm doing it, but I make 12% a year.
and it never you never it see a drop in your in yeah, your principal.
That quote was minus the laugh I threw in there to show.
You did?
Yeah.
He wasn't laughing? He wasn't cackling evilly at the end of the...
That was my own impression of what I think he should have said. I think he probably wouldn't have gotten as much money with the laugh involved. But, you know.
I got you. Yeah. Okay, so that was poetic license?
Right. I just threw that. I just felt like it was a good end statement to 12% a year.
That sounds good. I like that.
Okay, go ahead.
It's out there again. It's out there broad scale. And I, for better or worse, I am the target of, and so is Jake, I presume, although he never talks about it, the target of a tremendous amount of advertising from the financial services industry, from and stories about how brokers are making tremendous amounts of money, not for their clients, but for themselves. By the way, those brokers are called financial advisors. and I'm just going to say something right here. Anybody who calls himself a financial advisor, if you're working with somebody calling themselves a financial advisor, my objective fiduciary advice to you is get as far away from that person and get your money as far away from that person as you can comfortably afford to get.
I'm not sure I would go that far.
I am. I'm all the way out there now. Investment advisor is a different animal.
Yeah. It is a different animal.
And people don't know the difference, and I understand that. But the point is, financial advisor, there's a magazine called Financial Advisor, and there's one about, and they call themselves FAs now, the guys in financial planning and so on, about how to make more money, not for your clients.
There's a lot of articles in that.
Man, alive.
Magazine.
I mean, that's the front and back cover of Financial Planning magazine this month.
Financial Advisor.
No, magazine. Financial Planning magazine.
Oh, that
magazine.
Too. That too.
The front was this guy standing there purporting to make about a gazillion dollars a year and telling, are you keeping up making enough money for yourself? Forget your clients.
Right.
And on the back was another one where they promised, you know, basically, I could go into this at great length. But what I want to tell you is about the danger that's coming out of that. And there's two areas that I've read some very good papers on recently that I'm very sincere about. One is hedge funds. Anything that looks, acts, tastes, or smells like a hedge fund. Some very good academic studies have just come out and said, okay, hedge funds do things, the best hedge funds, the ones that theoretically are truly trying to hedge, which, by the way, claim 20% of the upside plus typically a 2% internal fee, and they get it for the people who manage them. The people who manage them have the yachts. How do they do that? How do they make money and pay their managers so much? Well, first off, they leverage. They borrow a lot of money in these things to magnify the movement. Secondly, they do things that work 90% of the time. The problem is nobody knows when the 10% of the time is coming, and when the 10% of the time is coming, you don't just lose money, it just goes away. And it does so suddenly and with no warning. So something that has done very, very well for years, which is what people tend to jump on, in the form of a hedge fund, and then blows up. Now, you say, well, I'm not a hedge fund investor. There are mutual funds now, well, actually mutual funds, ETFs, that are being issued that are sort of master hedge funds, which takes me to the second thing that I want to warn people about, and that there's a whole series of papers that says ETFs could easily be setting us up for the next 1987 market crash, and the reason is there is, and this is a word I don't use very often, but it's a lot of fun to use, a plethora of ETFs appearing in every direction. They are often very thinly traded. Let me say that again. They are often very thinly traded. There's
Why
a
is
lot
that important?
Of them. There's not a lot of buying and selling goes on compared with the size of, let's say, and there's no market maker. They don't have a market per se that they trade in. They sometimes do trade directly. Sometimes they're listed on exchanges. But the point is, they're an experimental investment. And when you combine what are called alts, alternative investments, which are illiquid, with ETFs, you get the same pattern that we saw with the mortgage obligations, and it may be years before they blow up, but I see a blow up coming. The pattern is mortgage securities, mortgages are pretty illiquid. You know, buying and selling your own mortgage doesn't work particularly well. When you package a lot of them together and you create a derivative, they become relatively liquid, relatively easy to buy and sell on the market, and they can start mixing in high yield, questionable, that's the nicest way of putting it, security or questionable base investments into the rest of the system, which, by the way, ties into what Jake was talking about debasing coins.
Right.
And they still trade, and they still look good, and they still behave the same. Well, what happens is, in order to increase the profit margin of the people who issue the ETFs, they increase the junk that's in there. And remember, hedge funds are pretty weird. High expense, high yield to the people who issue them. Does that sound like the mortgages, the high interest mortgages? They're sticking weird stuff inside the hedge funds, and the hedge funds are then being, in some cases, invested in by companies that issue ETFs in the investment. And people are trading the ETFs. This is a very, very critical point. The ETFs, the exchange-traded funds, are trading back and forth. But the underlying money that backs them, the underlying investment that backs them, theoretically, is in a hedge fund where they don't allow withdrawals. Folks, this is a setup for a blow-up. This is a highly complex scheme, which the British use the term a lot and without a negative connotation, that makes a tremendous amount of money for the people who originate it and pretends to be something like a mutual fund or a stock that has underlying fundamental value, when in fact the value that's in a lot of the ETFs that are trading right now is illiquid. It's an area where I would recommend great caution. It's an area where you could see a lockup or a drop in value. There's nothing, if you buy or sell a regular mutual fund, you got a federal law that defines what a mutual fund is. You have protection from creditors. But once you jump into an ETF, you are in the Wild West. They look, act, and taste like some kind of mutual fund that can be traded on the market every day. Why a person would want to trade a mutual fund on the market is beyond my comprehension, but that's all right. I'm just saying that as people are reaching for yield and they're reaching for more and more exotic investments, they're not really reaching as much as the brokers, the financial advisors are selling them, and there's a very good reason they're selling them. They pay really good commissions. And it's an area to be very, very cautious. That's not to say that every ETF is bad. I'm just simply saying, any more than I can say that every mortgage security was bad, because it wasn't. They were
right.
Good ones.
Right.
But there are some out there, and there's a proliferation of them out there that are untested, really dangerous securities that look safe based on completely illiquid high-risk investments. Man, what a combination. And again, we do this over and over again through history. And when we do this through history, we don't learn from it. And the reason we don't learn from it is the financial advisors who get paid high commissions, who, by the way, don't understand these things at all, sell them because they need to make a living. I mean, if you got paid $100 to sell one thing or $1,000 to sell the other, and the person you're selling it to pays the same amount of money for each of them, which would you sell? And you'd probably, if you're interested in making a living, you'd probably sell the one that pays you $1,000. Well, why does it pay you $1,000? Well, because it does, is the answer I've got, by the way, from financial advisors. So, excuse my rant, but I actually sat down and followed back on a series of advertisements I got and the brags about how many broker-dealer firms are using them and how many billions of dollars in them are being invested by members of the public. And it just saw the same pattern that I've seen before. Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
So we're down on indexed annuities and hedge fund ETFs.
Yes.
What else are we down on? You got some stuff you want to talk about.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about some things. It's kind of a big shift in the conversation. It doesn't follow with the same subject at all.
That's perfectly all right. The news shifts conversations every 10 to 15 seconds.
I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the problems that a lot of people had with Economics 101, Econ 101. They didn't understand it. It didn't make sense. They took the class and disliked it and went about their business. Well, if it did make sense to you and you took the class in the last decade, then you probably need to retake it with some newer material, because the stuff that they were teaching was just flat wrong. There are a lot of models that are used, and they're still being taught, which is one of the problems that I have with Econ 101. There's a lot of models that are used that there's this thing that people think that we're rational, that we put the same weight of value on two different numbers or the same number from two different directions. And I'll give you an example if you're interested. Are you interested in an example?
I'm interested in all X amples.
Okay.
That means there used to be enough.
Okay. In normal economics up till recently, when they're teaching it to your undergraduate student or in a high school, the concept of money, say $100 is $100. And you would think, well, of course, $100 is $100. It has the value of it is $100. So why should it change? Well, if you have $1, and I say tomorrow you're going to have $100, what is your feeling? What would you say to that?
I would say that I have $100.
Yeah, it's very nice. You've got $100. That's good. Okay. Now, today, if you have $200 and I say tomorrow you will have $100, what is your feeling about that?
I don't have any feelings about it.
If you're going to lose $100 to have $100. If I say...
I'm going to lose... you're talking to me. This is Jeff.
Right, that's true.
And actually, I've done that so often. But if I lose the... If I have $200 today and I lose $100 and it's worth $100 tomorrow, but in doing so, I have converted... No.
We're talking about actual money. We're not buying things.
Unless I receive something in return for the $100 that disappeared, I would not be particularly pleased
with
that.
You're not happy with that. Okay.
No.
So, wait a minute. In one scenario, you have $100, and tomorrow you have a dollar, and tomorrow you have $100.
Right.
You say, "Oh, this is good. I have $100." In another scenario, you have $200, and tomorrow you have $100. You say, "Oh, this is bad. I have $100." $100 has a different value depending on where you start from.
Or from where you start.
Yes. Right. So. The concept there of an anchor point, a reference point, is something that was completely missing in the old economics classes.
Right.
They said $100 was worth $100, and it's always worth
$100. But it's not. No.
$100 may be worth a lot to you, and it may be worth a little to you. And here's another example. An example of where the current economic thought is very different from what's being taught to new people as they go into economics. All right, if you have a probability of spectrum, you've got 100% probability means something is sure to happen, and a 1% probability is only 1/100th of that.
Right.
The old economic model said that each 1% is equal to every other 1%.
No.
Because
The old economic model says it, but I don't think so.
Right, correct. This equal weighting to all percentages. So if somebody says you have a 50% chance tomorrow of having $50, you would think each 1% is worth $1, and that's what the old model said. Here's the problem. If you have a 0% chance of getting money tomorrow, and you go up to 1%. And say tomorrow you have a 1% chance of getting $100. According to the numbers that we look at regularly for the lottery, people are willing to pay more than a dollar for that 1% chance.
Yep.
We say, okay, that first 1% is worth a lot. Then you get to, say, the difference between 5% and 6%. People are not willing to pay even a dollar for that.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it gets really cool. The last 1%, from 99% to 100. If I say tomorrow you have a 99% chance of having $100, or you can pay me $5 and you'll have a 100% chance of having
it. They'd pay for it in a heartbeat.
Right. So each percentage point has a different value, and it has a different value based on references that you hold in your head. There's an emotion behind all of this. This is behavioral economics, and they don't teach it in Econ 101. So the concepts that I'm talking about here when we talk about history, when I am explaining why banks exist, in the old economics models, they exist for very number-specific reasons, when the reality of the world is that those numbers have different values depending on where you're standing and where somebody else is standing. And go ahead.
There's something that goes with that. I don't know if it's in what you were studying that I read today. Inflation expectations are something that are surveyed by different organizations, and they're very, very important. And the reason inflation expectation is important is if people expect high inflation in the future, they change their behavior and they create high inflation.
Right.
And if they expect deflation, even though they don't recognize they're expecting deflation, they change their behavior and they create deflation.
An example of that is if you think that gas prices are going up.
Oh, wait a minute, you're getting ahead of me.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead. I'll let you finish.
You can talk about flat screen TVs, but lay off the gas for a minute. Okay?
All right, go ahead.
This is what generates the largest single factor generating inflation expectations, according to a study that was published last week, is gas prices.
There you go.
Because, and the reason is, people fill up typically at least once a week.
Right.
Secondly, there's these big numbers posted.
Huge numbers.
All over the place. Even if
they're better than headlines,
we are having deflation or near deflation in the United States, if the price of gasoline goes from $3 to $3.50 and a survey is done, people across the country think we're having inflation and they anticipate inflation in the future. And you're going to think this is really strange. It is the reverse of traditional economics. And the reason the study was done is because if the price of gasoline goes up, we should see the economy slow down.
Right.
Because there's less money available to spend on other things.
But people tend to spend faster because they see the money.
Right. If they see the price of gasoline going up, they use their credit cards more.
Yep. Which causes more inflation.
Right. Well, actually, it hasn't caused much inflation recently. That's the other thing that's interesting. The forecast of inflation by the inflation surveys it used to be apparently a significant issue. It's not anymore.
Right.
But the fascinating thing is that if you really want to invigorate the economy, now this is one of those things where you got to hang on to your seat on this one. What they said is what you should be doing is gradually raising gasoline prices because people seeing gasoline prices go up cause them to purchase things they're otherwise going to purchase quicker because they anticipate the cost of flat screen TVs will go up because gasoline is.
Right.
Which, in fact, is the opposite of the truth. People's perception of reality economically
is the opposite. It generally is the opposite of the truth.
It probably has a lot to do with the fact that there's so little taught about it in the public or private education system.
And even when it is taught, it's taught on models that don't make sense anymore.
They never made any sense. I studied and it didn't make any sense.
It didn't make sense. And when we're talking about behavior, suddenly people go, that's what I do too. If we're talking about inflation and we're talking about gas prices, if you think that gas prices are going to be up next week, they're going to be up significantly less next week.
You'll go buy gasoline.
Even if you've got half a tank of gas and you usually wait till it's empty, you're going to go buy more gas now, which causes the price of gas to go up because more people are buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're talking about flat screen TVs, which is what old Baldy across from me was just making a reference to. I understand now that dangling participles are now included in the English grammatical.
But they're illegal for me.
So okay, all right. So I will refrain from dangling too many participles.
Okay. It causes me to start to snap at them. You know, I'm partially fish, I guess.
All right. So if you wait to buy your flat screen TV because you know the sale in December around Christmas is going to make the price come down, then you are making the price come down by waiting till Christmas to buy it.
Right.
How's that for weird?
It's normal.
If a lot of people stop buying things because they think the price is going to come down, then the price will have to come down to make people buy things.
And then people will get laid off and they'll wish they hadn't bought things,
right,
and they'll buy fewer things.
Which is the problem with deflation.
Right.
Is that if everybody starts doing that with every item, waiting to buy something till the price comes down, then the price has to come down. And if you can't make that item for less money than you currently make the item, then your profit margin gets smaller.
Didn't we just see that happen with Amazon?
We absolutely did. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
Or, and this is true, because Amazon people were waiting to buy things, so the profit margin goes down.
Right.
If the profit margin goes to zero, the company goes out of business, which means you cannot any longer buy those things.
Which causes the price to go up.
Right. Well, but at that point, it's too late.
Well, people will sell them on eBay.
Right. Well, that's assuming that you didn't lose your job in the process. Because
yes.
If every item's price is going down and you can't make the item for less money than it currently takes, then you might lose your job because you're waiting to buy a flat screen TV and the flat screen TV buyer is waiting to buy the product that you make for less money too.
And
you both lose your jobs and you talk about the horrible corporations.
And as the price of computers came down and continues to come down, the people at Dell who got laid off are not able to buy new houses.
Correct.
And we have the resulting. And one of the reasons that our economy is recovering very slowly at this point again is the single largest mover in the economy traditionally is the house construction business. I mean,
correct.
That's a lot of money. And it just isn't happening. And there's a couple of reasons it isn't happening. One is banks, mortgage companies.
They don't want to give you money.
Well, they don't want to give you money because the regulators are on them tightly because they did such a poor job of loaning money in the past.
And they also don't want to lose the money.
And they are the regulators are overreacting to it, probably. The banks are scared of losing money because they got burned in that area. And you start down this list. Okay, so people don't want to, the majority of houses that were sold last year there were more houses sold last year by far. And this is the interesting thing. The majority, and by majority, and I keep saying that word.
Majority.
Meaning over 51% of the house purchased, not the individual houses purchased.
Only half of the house.
But when people go in and get a mortgage, many of the mortgages were like for 40% of the value of the house.
So that's a very large down payment.
Right. And so people were paying cash for houses. Now, this is an interesting point. Why? Because they were grabbing houses that were below what they thought they were worth, and they were willing to pay a lot of money for that.
A lot of money out of pocket.
Right. And now the banks we saw the housing recovery start. The banks were still being very restrictive on their lending, very conservative. Well, now, as the price of houses came up last year, and you may have heard of any of the second houses, resale houses, price came up and said, okay, the recovery started, everything's cool, and it stalled. Well, the reason it stalled is because the bargain basement houses sold out of foreclosure are pretty much gone. And so now you have a market where houses are priced where they're priced, but the banks won't loan, in many cases, a lot of money. Now, if you have a really high credit score, which means you really could probably pay for it with cash, then the bank will loan you money. So
right.
Banks are back into their traditional
yes.
mode.
I will loan you an umbrella as long as it's not raining.
That's right. And this, or even forecast to rain. And the end result is what we have come to believe since World War II, when the GIs came back, the GI Bill came out, and returning soldiers, sailors, airmen,
Marines,
whatever, coming back from the war, could buy a new house for $1 down. Actually, no money down, but they paid a little bit of something. And the end result was we had this construction boom, and we had a lot of people who previously had not lived in a house that they had, quote, owned, end quote, who had rented instead, moving into houses. And that has driven our economy. It's been a major driver in our economy from World War II to the present. And a lot of people, a lot of economists, keep waiting for that boom to come back. And the fact is, it may not come back. All of that was based on government guarantees of loans. And in case you haven't noticed it,
they're not doing that very often anymore.
If you listen to our discussions last week and our other discussions, the government has promised a lot of things in the future that are very expensive. And one of the reasons, by the way, that we had a big deficit, and we have an unusually large federal debt based on all of our history right now, is because the government did guarantee a lot of mortgages. And many of those mortgages that had government guarantees associated with them didn't work out so well. And so the government has had to go back in and cover those mortgages, and it's got everybody scared. Now, an awful lot of investors lost money, too, tremendous amount of investor losses. But even in the investor losses, for instance, when a bank loses a lot of Washington Mutual, which went a bank going bankrupt, that's really an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's what they did.
When all those deposits that theoretically would have disappeared before were covered by our government, and our government went out and borrowed money, issued Treasury securities to keep the people who had deposits at Washington Mutual from losing their money. Of course, a lot of people object to that, and they say the government shouldn't do that. They should allow all the people to lose their money. But they obviously haven't read about the Great Depression. Anyway.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So that's what – it's an awful lot of what's going on. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number is near. We're going to play some commercials. Our 773-1400 or
– 1-866-597-1400.
And if today is Saturday, April 26th, you're certainly welcome to call in and ask us questions or give us thoughts on the other side of commercials that we're going to play here and stimulate our brain and get us on some interesting subjects. We'll be back after these words from KTEM sponsors.
Call now, 800-260-5765. That's 800-260-5765. U.S. Tax Professionals, 800-260-5765.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number is calling here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Elizabeth in Temple.
Hello,
and
Elizabeth von Temple.
I'm curious about what your opinion is about what would happen to the economy of Britain and Scotland if Scotland decides to go independent. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Oh, good question.
But the Scots are going to be in a world of hurt, lad.
Yeah.
They will no longer be a member of the economic union.
Yeah.
No longer have any treaties with the United States for trade.
Yeah. They won't be able to print money until they figure out how to do that.
Right.
Bank of England notes won't. They can no longer use them.
Right. Tax collection will have to be completely new. So there's a lot of issues that have to be worked out there.
It'll work about as well as the Confederate States of America.
Right, which is to say that
possibly without the war.
Yeah, the war probably won't happen, and there's some other ethical and moral issues that weren't involved here, but the concept is...
stupid.
Yes. It's kind of like if California decided to secede from the United States.
Because our government was discussing, our governor was discussing that.
Only in kind of passing.
In passing, yes. He was doing fast thinking without consulting his brain.
Right. In the reality of the world, Texas right now is spending more money in federal taxes than it is paying in federal taxes. Now, during the recession, that was very much reversed. We spent a lot more in taxes than we received. Scotland as a whole receives a large amount more from the benefit of the taxes than what they pay in taxes.
Yeah, but it would like cause – they're on hold.
Okay.
And we got a caller. I know you're there. It would cause a depression in Texas if we seceded, even though
– we have a great economy.
Because, like, we'd have to have an army.
We'd have to figure out how do we trade even with the United States.
Yeah, we don't have any treaties with anybody, right. And
the whole concept of free trade with Mexico would go out the window because Mexico's free trade agreement is with the United States.
And everybody would start going around Texas to get to places.
Right.
It would be a disaster economically. And how will it affect the United States economy? The price of whiskey would probably go up if you like Scotch whiskey, but it's already too high, so it doesn't make a lot of difference.
Yeah, well, Scotch whiskey right now has had some the amount of exports from Scotland has dropped drastically in the last few years.
Oh, well, at any rate,
interesting.
The point is that it would have
economically
very
speaking,
little effect on the United States economically, and it would be devastating to Scotland.
And to England, it would be slightly painful.
Yes, and they would probably repent of their sins very quickly. We have another caller on 773-1400 who just hung up on us. That was interesting.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, we got another one?
No. I just need to figure out how to turn it off.
There we
okay.
go. All right.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say something. What would be the effect on the United States? I really thought the next thing was going to be if we put sanctions on Russia. Okay, we got a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I hate to call back a second time, but the last thing we were talking about, something that I've been talking about for years to friends of mine on a theory, I guess you call it a theory that I had, and you discussed the gas prices and the housing market.
Right.
I want to validate what you said about World War II veterans buying their first house for a dollar down. I bought my first house in 1969, and I only had to pay $2 down.
Right.
Well, you know, it doubled by 69.
Yeah, the prices are doubling that fast. That's pretty amazing.
That second dollar was very important to you, I'm sure.
But anyway, when the housing market collapsed, I always felt that if you go back about 10 years ago, people were buying houses on an adjustable rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, after a 2 or 3 year period, that house, that mortgage rate would jump up $200-$400 a month.
Exactly.
Well, about that same time, gas was about $1 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that far? I know y'all can.
I can remember when it was 25 cents a gallon.
Right. And I remember gas started creeping up. And one day I pulled into a gas station, and regular gas was $1.25. And I said, I am not paying $1.25 for a gallon of gas. And I drove all over town.
And you've been walking ever since.
Right. Less than $1.25. Of course,
right.
I spent 10 times as much. But,
yeah.
But still, the point being is that during about that same period of time, gas went from about $1 a gallon up to $3.50, $4 a gallon.
Right.
So if you were spending $100 a month on gas, you were suddenly spending $300 and $400 a month on gas. Well, that dovetailed right into the people that had these adjustable rate mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Their mortgage was supposed to go up $300 or $400 a month. They could have made that had gas prices not gone up.
Well,
and I think that the gas prices going up was what, to me, is what caused the collapse of the mortgage.
It took quite a while for gas prices to go from $1 to $3. It took years.
It didn't happen overnight, but it happened in the 2 or 3 year period that the people, when they bought their adjustable rate mortgage, during that time, gas was going up. So eventually they were spending $300 or $400 a month on gas instead of being able to use that same amount of money to pay the adjusted upward rate on the mortgage.
There could be a connection there. Yeah. I don't think you're going to find a good tight connection there, because basically it wasn't a matter of what caused those people's finances to blow up. Even the studies that have come out since then said even with no increase in expenses, they could not have afforded the higher prices later on. The plan that they were sold was your house will appreciate so much you can take an equity loan and use the equity loan to make house payments with.
Okay, let me go back to historic prices of gas.
Think about how stupid that one is.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to go back to historic gas prices. You're absolutely correct. 10 years back, the price of gas was about $1.50. It spiked from $1.50. It spiked in 2004. It was up to $3. And then it dropped back down. And then it went right back up to $3. And it's kind of hovered around $3 from about 2005 all the way up to 2008. In late 2007, it spiked at $4 a gallon. And we think, okay, late 2007, we're talking about, this is when it sounds like these numbers are correlating exactly with your theory. It sounds okay, except then we had a drop in gas prices in early 2008. It dropped all the way down to less than $2 a gallon.
I remember that.
It was $1.70, $1.80.
That should have rescued a lot of people's mortgages.
And it took several years for it to climb back up above $3 a gallon. And now we've been kind of hovering around between $3 and $3.85 for about 6 years now. So if you think back, what you're saying is correct. Cost of gas has been increasing. But that huge spike up to $4 changed the way we bought cars. It changed a lot of things. And it happened to coincide with a drastic downturn, which is why gas prices dropped so fast. So again, correlates with what you're saying. People stopped buying gas all of a sudden. The price dropped really, really low because they were going, how are we going to pay our mortgage? How it was enough people stopped buying gas that it dropped below $2 a gallon. And then almost immediately came right back up.
You know, that's one of the problems with gasoline is it's what's called inelastic demand.
It changes so fast that it's really hard. You know, there's another aspect of this. People change their lifestyles. Their one aspect of their lifestyle that's difficult to change is their housing. If gas prices go up and they are already paying a lot of money on their mortgage and then their mortgage jumps, then they stop driving. And that's what we saw in that spike. So you're
well,
right.
The majority of the gas that a person uses is to go to and from work.
Correct.
Work related. They've got to go to work to earn a paycheck just to pay for the groceries and other things, and they can let their mortgage slide.
Correct. And the difference here in what happened probably is people started carpooling with their spouse, or one spouse lost their job. And that had an impact on gas prices, but now it's back up to $3.50, and we're talking about... So you're right in that the cost of energy does have an impact on the economy.
The other, but again, the margin, the area where the greatest discrepancies occurred and actually caused the collapse, were houses that were bought with not with the intent of people living there.
Right.
You and I... here in Central Texas, because we never saw a housing bubble, find that to be so alien that people would buy houses without any intent of ever living in the house or renting it. But there was a tremendous number of houses. For instance, the single largest input to the housing collapse, to the bond collapse, wasn't even poor people buying houses they couldn't afford. Now, those were the egregious examples that we like to pay attention to.
Those are the examples people talk about all the time.
And they were there, and that was a factor. The biggest single one was what's called Alt-A's, which is people who are A-rated credit risks who bought houses, signed documents that said they were going to move into the house. In other words, they're already living in a house, and they had another house built. Or they bought another house that somebody else had built recently with, and they signed on the document they intended to live in the house. Now, if they live in the house, the chances of them failing to pay the mortgage, given their income levels and job levels, are extremely low. They basically said, we're going to sell the house we're living in now, and then we're going to move into this other house, or we're buying it as a vacation house, and we'll live in it, or whatever. They had no intention of living in it. They wanted to flip it.
And that actually, there were people that were buying three or four houses. And eventually, there were so many houses. The vast majority of houses that were foreclosed upon were empty.
Yeah, and Nevada is still suffering from that tremendously.
They were buying them as investment property, yeah. And they said, we're not going to do anything to it. We're going to buy it, and then we're going to sell it, and we're going to make money somehow
it
from magic.
It was a speculative idea that the price of houses keeps going up. And it was exactly the same thing that happened in 1640. With the collapse of the tulip bulbs in Holland, it was the same thing that happened with South Sea shares in 1720. I mean, you go through history and you see this event happening over and over. By the way, in 1837, we had the same precise thing going on
with real estate. It wasn't another bubble. It was exactly the same bubble.
The Louisiana Purchase was there. The government managed to get out of debt by selling land in the Louisiana Purchase. And there's some other complexities to this, but people were selling the land to each other, never having seen the property. They just had a piece of paper that said they owned some land someplace out west, and they had the meets and bounds of the property on the deed. Now, the fact is, in many cases, the land had never even been surveyed, just like we had exactly the same thing occur in California in the housing bubble. And we had it occur in Nevada where people weren't even sure they owned the house, and the people loaning the money were robo-signing, and dead people were signing loans.
This is really interesting. In some cases, and this is rare occurrence, but it's something that we can look at and say, how did that happen? The same house was sold to three different people. And none of them knew it because none of them lived there.
Yes. And so if you really want to see the origin of any kind of a collapse of the nature that we saw, it always works out to the same thing. Once people start getting greedy and reaching for either yield or gain
beyond reasonable expectation, going back to history.
It's
yeah, I'd heard about the the investors and speculators that did just what you said about buying houses.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know a lot of people, and of course have for years, I don't know of anyone that did not buy a house, that did not move into and live in it. Now, I'm sure maybe in the larger cities, maybe a lot of that stuff went on in a lot larger scale.
We missed it in Texas.
Just, judging from what happens around here, it just seemed to me that the spike in gasoline prices and the ARMs coming due hit about the same time, and people could not afford both gas and the higher mortgage rate.
And I'm sure that happened in some places. But actually, there's been people look at that. The reason, and you're going to think this is a little crazy, the reason gasoline went up is because people were feeling rich, and
they bought a lot of SUVs,
flipping a lot of houses, and doing a lot of driving because they felt rich and they were buying. You remember the kind of vehicle we were buying back then? They looked like tanks,
27-foot long Bonnevilles,
right?
And Hummers that got they got 5 miles to the gallon.
The concept of how you feel determines how you spend. And if you feel like you own a lot of stuff, even if the debt is worth more than the houses, you feel like you can spend a lot. As soon as that value starts dropping, even though it hasn't even impacted, here's a great example. He was talking about Alt-A's. These are people that actually can afford the houses that they bought. The value of the house dropped. They can still afford the mortgages on all of these buildings. They're still paying the mortgage, but they stopped spending elsewhere because they felt poor. They felt,
and the lower income people that was on the ARM that suddenly were looking at a $300 or $400 a month jump.
Yeah,
and the reason why they and their jobs started going away because the other people with those alt A's stopped spending, and so the people that were in the lower income stopped getting money, and then they
it's all a feedback loop, and it's circular, and
it's like a woven net.
If you really want something that will either drive you completely crazy or utterly fascinate you, just start digging into the causes and effects, and you find out some of the effects are the causes and some of the causes are the effects.
And thanks. I know you're coming up at the end of the hour, so I'll let you go. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
And I wanted to say something before we got off of here.
Right.
I had one little piece.
Go ahead.
Do you have something?
I was just going to give contact information for us. We missed it last hour, so
couple of minutes. Okay, I just want to say the Commerce Department came out with a really fascinating report, at least to me. I'm a geek.
I think that's an oxymoron to say Commerce Department came out with a fascinating report.
Bureau of Economic Analysis, actually, the bureaucrats came out with one. And they broke down the GDP of the United States by sector, by industry. The largest, 19.6% in 2013 of the gross domestic product of the United States was created by financial institutions.
Interesting.
Government is number two at 13%. And this is really fascinating. Manufacturing, 12.4. Education and healthcare, 12%. And it goes on. The thing I found fascinating about it was that the government is only 13% of our economy. And it's shrinking, steadily shrinking, year after year after year as a percentage of our economy. Of all the developed nations on the planet, we have the lowest percentage of our economy that is, quote, and when I say government, I don't just mean federal,
we're
all the way down.
We're talking state, local, everything.
We have the lowest percentage of governmental whatever activity in our economy.
This is me clapping in the
and
background.
And we are the ones who are complaining the most about it. Which
means we're going to make it smaller, which, again, me clapping in the
background. I would actually be more concerned about the fact that 20%, roughly 20% of our total economic output just has to do with moving money around.
Well, yeah.
And only 12% is manufacturing. That would bug me.
Us being in that industry and saying that the industry is too big is it's true. There are too many people in the financial industry. There's too much money being made in the financial industry. It is friction on the economy.
Yeah. And
that's not good.
Fascinating. It's a little bit scary, too. Okay, anyway, you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. and we function during the week sometimes, occasionally, as an investment advisory firm. We manage portfolios for people. If you'd like to talk about the radio show or comment or anything else, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. On the weekend, we have a voicemail during the week. We have live people who answer the telephone. We don't have a voicemail during the week. It's there. We don't use it. You can give us a call locally at 947-1111, or
you can also reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts. You can look at our scary and bald faces. Our faces aren't bald. Our faces are bearded, but our heads are bald. You can...
Well, we could not be bald-faced liars.
That's true, because we have beards. If you would like to contact us, you can do it. There's a Contact Me section there, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We put some effort into that webpage, and we would actually like some feedback on that, too. If it's easier to read, please.
Yeah, whatever.
Have a suggestion, let us know.
And if you have any ideas what you want us to talk about on the show, certainly give us a call or send us an email, jeff@tpwc or jake@tpwc. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about. We'll hunt it up and we'll try to get to it. So we do this and have done it for a long time. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.